Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, Sports City. Welcome to the Sunday Morning Brunch, man. I'm feeling real good, man, and I can't sit on this situation any longer. Football is here now. Football is here now. There's a game to be played today. I know people are at the edge of their seat. We got a lot of stuff to jump into, from the induction to the game today to the brawl. We got it all, man. Sports City, y'all just stay focused, buckle up. We got to take y'all on a significant ride here in the kitchen. I done took off this blazer, loosened up the tie, stepped aside. The kitchen timeless is alive.
Oh, welcome to Sports City. TP Timeless is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Timeless holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to back rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you people.
Good morning. It's a Sports City chef with Sunday the Brunch with Mark and TP.
Good morning.
So kick back, relax, enjoy this. Everybody, don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday Morning Brunch with Mark, the Moses, and TP Thomas.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, in 2 hours of facts, and that's a fact, yeah.
The caller number is 917-889-9592. Like I said, you got the next 90 minutes locked and loaded with Sports City. Y'all could have been anywhere else in the world, but you're here with the chefs. And I know, and look, Sports City, thank you to everybody that's out there that's been checking us out. However you've been checking out, the downloads have been great. Whether it's iTunes or you're catching us on either page, I'm putting us up on Vibe. Everything that you see us, you come in here to get your dishes or your kitchen work. However you do it, I'm saying this thankful toward the Sports City chefs. I have to, everybody out there. Now, it's a very interesting situation, and the reason why I say that is because they must have heard us yesterday or something, because I was getting email to the sportscitychefs@gmail.com. If you're sending us an email, y'all want to hear us or whatever. And they're like, Ty, I'm glad to hear the football talk is back. Can I be on the show? I want to be on the football show. Y'all already know. So at the top of the show, like I said, the calling number is 917-889-9592. Come down here and get your dish, man. We got food for thought for days. And like I said, man, I'm thankful. I'm thankful on behalf of Sports City. I speak for the rest of the chefs. I got my brother here with me, so people start to get in line here, calling in by way of the state of South Carolina from the borough of Brooklyn up here in New York. Chandler Knight, a.k.a. Nostradamus, welcome to the brunch. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm all right, man. What's going on?
Doing all right. See, I got work to do. It's just me and him till we kick off. Okay. So we do have somebody else here. You got to get his coffee and mojo together, calling in by way of the state of Arizona. Mr. Silver, a.k.a. Nacho, welcome to the brunch. How are you feeling this morning?
You know, I think I'm kind of feeling some way. You know, I was listening to some old shows, and almost everyone, you say, calling from the state of, by the way of, because they're usually from another state, and I'm the only sad sap that's never left Arizona in this daggone heat, but I'm feeling okay. You know, it's a good morning, early morning out here in Arizona, but it's still hot.
See, and that's the problem. You're sitting around in that 117-degree heat, man, brother. You're trying to dial that stuff back, man. I can't sit out there in that heat, man. So one day you'll escape the sun. I guess you like being cooked. It's okay because you get cooked in the kitchen too, so it's okay. So you might like the heat. You might like the heat. No, let me stop playing around. Like I said, I'm happy to see what's going on in the kitchen. And like I said at the top of the show, I can no longer sit on the situation. I've tried. And Chandler said about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, don't steal my summer from me. We still got a summer. Well, guess what, Chandler? I'm sorry. August is here. And a football game is to be played today. So round of applause, everybody, for the football game that's going to be played. the Hall of Fame game is to be played today. We'll get into that game, see how people feel about both teams and what they're going to watch for, because, you know, we're not going to see too much of the starters, you know, guys like AP, Mike Wallace, those guys. We'll get into all of that. But I do want to get into the Hall of Fame induction and see how you guys feel about it. A long list of people. I'm going to date myself, and I don't take this personal, Sports City. I actually feel good in saying this, but majority of the people that got inducted last night to the Hall of Fame, I see majority of their careers going from Bettis Well, let me say full names. I'm not going to sit up here and just say their last name or how I had it listed. But Jerome Bettis, Charles Haley, Junior Seau, Tim Brown, Will Shields. Now, it gets shaky for me for Ron Wolf and Bill Polian. These guys have been, you know, in the league longer than I could recollect. So we'll dive into as much as we can with the information that I also have here listed as well. But this is where I say I'm dating myself. I've seen all of these guys that I just mentioned previously, from Bettis to Tim Brown, Will Shields, Charles Haley, and Junior Seau, from start to finish. Like I remember them coming to the league, playing ball, and now, you know, retiring and, you know, deserving this honor of them getting into the Hall of Fame. So this is where I say I'm dating myself, because I was a fan of all of it, whether they were rivals or not. You know, you still had to respect what these guys brought to a football game, so on and so forth. Now, I don't know if we want to go into them individually or, you know, speak of them in, you know, one by one text, but we can do it however we like. I do, you know, hold significance toward, you know, guys like Jerome Bettis or Junior Seau and Charles Haley also, while he was jumping back and forth from the Cowboys and the Niners and picking up championships, you know, along the way as well. Well, see how you guys feel about it, man, in Sports City. So I open up. I come to you first, Chandler. I don't know if you want to do this one by one or go and talk to these guys in a full context. We'll do one by one because we got a lot of time here. So first and foremost, I'll start off with the Junior Seau situation and how heartfelt the conversation went with his daughter. And she was trying her best not to get overwhelmed with emotion. And I give her, you know, a round of applause for standing up there for the Seau family and speaking. And you know a lot of things that Junior Seau did. He always included his mom and father, and she definitely did that. So it was almost, you know, kind of reminder of what Junior would go out there and say. So, you know, that was cool on how they represented Junior Seau. So we'll go each individual first and then see how this closes out throughout the show. Chandler, your thoughts on Junior Seau, his career, and him finally getting inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Well, Junior Seau was supposed to be a Jet, and the Jets passed on him. That's my first memory of Junior Seau, is that the Jets didn't draft him. But, I mean, listen, the guy was a great player. He was one of the guys, kind of like you said, that even though he was on another team, he was a guy you could root for. I was stationed in San Diego when he was in his heyday with the Chargers, you know, when they were still playing down there. Well, they wound up changing the name to Qualcomm Stadium when, you know, the old stadium, not the new stadium they got, but the old stadium they had. All right. I remember going there, man, you know, because we get free tickets when we was in the service, man, and we'd be sitting up in the nosebleeds and you couldn't even tell who was who. There wasn't no jumbotrons and nothing other nonsense then. You know, you had to bring some damn binoculars. But you would always tell who the layout ant was, because he was the one moving the fastest and hitting everything. But, I mean, I know people who met him personally who you know, because he lived in San Diego area while he spent with the Chargers. I know people who met him, who knew him personally, some people who knew some of his kids and things like that. So I'd never heard a bad word said about the man. I mean, in most athletes and people meet him, there's always somebody who's got something negative to say about him. Of everyone I know who's met him, some professional athletes, some business people, some just regular fans, nobody ever had a bad word to say about the guy. You know, he could be out with his family trying to enjoy a meal or something, and people would stop and ask him, you know, autographs and this and that, and he would always give up his time. And if he couldn't, you know, he would real politely say, you know, can you just give me a minute? I'm with my family. And he would find a way to try to do something for those people. And you heard his daughter mention it to him, buddy. That was his thing. Whenever he met anybody, he always said, hey, buddy, how are you, buddy? You know, he could, and it would make people feel like they'd known him for years. You know what I'm saying? Just some regular person on the street. That was what he said, because he greeted everybody like they were a friend. So I think his daughter did a tremendous job. All of his kids did. I think the NFL finally got it right with the way they did it. I still don't agree with that particular rule, but I think in this case they did the best they could in not breaking the rule, because if there is a rule and then you allow her to speak, but you haven't allowed others, then, you know, you're saying that he's more important than other people. So they made the best of a bad situation, and they found a way to allow her to speak, but at the same time keeping the spirit of the rule intact, I guess. So, you know, it was great. It really was. It was great.
Yeah, and the thing about it is her being questioned, because I think they kind of wanted to script it out and not have something be you know, address what people feel like it wasn't deservedly so to be on TV, so on and so forth. And I feel similar to what you feel about the situation. I feel like she could have been open and speaking out there, but she'd have been on national TV and probably said something about, you know, the lawsuit that, you know, going around right now with the CTE situation and you know, supposedly something that could have driven what happened to Junior. But, the vivid memory I have of Junior Seau is just like Chandler says, the guy, and it, I think it's more or less, and I hate to say it like this, but I have to, I think it's something about the Samoan nature of, I guess, playing football. Because if I think of Junior Seau, I also think of, like, Haloti Ngata, and I also think of Troy Polamalu. These guys love to attack the line of scrimmage, love to do it. So thinking about Junior Seau was always that linebacker. I mean, he made plays in the midst of the field, but he always was that guy that shot the gap. He got to the running back as soon as he possibly could or got to the quarterback before he could make a play, and everybody remembers that punch that he would throw vividly to make sure that he ended the play. You know what I'm saying? So it's stuff like that that I remember about Junior Seau. And when Junior Seau came to the league playing for the Chargers, I mean, at that given time, I mean, they would put up games and win games and lose games, so on and so forth. But Junior Seau was the first face and name that you would recognize with the San Diego Chargers at that given time when he came to the league around, like, 1989, 1990, and moving forward and giving the NFL 20 years of play, a majority of that, in which he was in San Diego. I mean, at the end of his career, he was, you know, passed from the Dolphins and also the Patriots as well. But everybody vividly remembers him playing down in Southern California. Nacho, your thoughts on Junior Seau, you know, a very recognizable middle linebacker. Any memories that you have, and also your thoughts on the induction situation with his daughter, Sydney, also.
Just the fact that, you know, for Seau and his journey to the NFL and where he's from, the fact that he was born in San Diego, went to school 90 miles away from San Diego, was drafted by San Diego, and played his career for the Chargers, and it was just so, storybook written in that, you know, he was the hometown hero, got drafted in the first round by his hometown team. So it gets really storybook there, and I think the fact that that's coupled with a man who wasn't driven by most things like greed or ambition or anything like that or just necessity. He was driven by his family, his ancestors, and just pretty much the love that he got from his friends, his family, his teammates. That's what drove him. And I think one of the quotes is he was driven by fear, and fear to be an average player. And when you're driven by that, and when you have the mindset that he had, it leads to great things. And so we saw it on the field. And I read recently when we were reading about this, talking about the daughter, and I read an article about him. An article pretty much said the hall was built by Junior Seau's, so to speak, players like him, so we can immortalize the man he was for 20-plus odd years in the NFL and before that, the man he was off the field, on the field, in the locker room, outside the locker room, dealing with coaches and players, dealing with fans, dealing with everyone. He's what every single fan person aspires to be like. And like Chandler said, just the way he made you feel, whether you were, you know, the man who signed his checks or he was signing your jersey, he made you feel like you were the most important person at that time. And I've never personally met him. Watching him play towards the end of his years, I grew to like him. I grew to love him as a player, as a person. There was nothing ever I saw wrong or anything at all. So it just, you know, to see him leave the game and the way he went out, how he went out, not necessarily the end part, but the game itself was how most players, I think, would dream of having their careers. Take away the CTE and what happens years after that. But from the start of his NFL being to how it ended in San Diego, I think most players would dream to have a career like his.
And definitely. He got to actually two Super Bowls, one with the Chargers and one with the Patriots as well, while they were on that epic 18-0 run before it ended in the Super Bowl up against the New York Giants. And there was only one crazy situation that he got into, and that was when he was on the Dolphins and he picked that LaDainian Tomlinson, but they used to play together. So I understood where he was coming from, but the thing that he said, I guess a lot of people didn't find tasteless at the given time that he made the statement, but nevertheless, you could never really think of any situation around Junior Seau and point negative. Unless you were somebody on the opposing team and just got smacked by him on a previous play. That's probably the only thing that stick up bad about Junior Seau, because this dude was a monster and built like a Mack truck as well, man, an epic career. And I think him and there's a couple of people that we get into when they made his the statue or the bust, the Hall of Fame bust. They got it right on target. It looked just like Junior Seau, you know, recognizable. You'll get some of those that don't look like the individual. But I think whoever made that, you know, the bust of him did an excellent job on Junior Seau. I was actually caught up in trying to hold back tears because it's sad that, you know, how his life ended based around the effort that he put out there on the football field. That's why it was sad to me, like, That was partial the reason. I'm guessing that's partial the reason of why he took his own life. But nevertheless, Junior Seau, one class guy, and deservedly so to be in the Hall of Fame. And now kind of joining this together with the next individual, and I watched this guy heavily since college, since he was in college at Notre Dame, being Jerome Bettis, the bus. We all know him as the bus, and it's crazy, because I remember when he was a freshman at Notre Dame, and then he was a bit thinner than what he was when he got to the NFL with him, Richie Waters, all of those guys in that backfield when it was tough to deal with Notre Dame. And Jerome Bettis actually, in his induction speech, spoke towards Sidney and the Seau family and, you know, congratulated them on Junior getting into the league and talking about how much of a class act he was. But Jerome Bettis talking about his struggles and, you know, they all have those heartfelt situations, and he spoke on his father, and he spoke on his mom as well, his mom battling cancer, and she went to every one of his games, regardless of her situation, too, so that's pretty epic. But I want to, you know, go back and forth about the Jerome Bettis situation, his induction as well, from him coming to the league from the Rams and then going and making a big splash, getting in Pittsburgh and finally getting a Super Bowl ring while he was with the Pittsburgh Steelers in the middle of Detroit, where he's from. So that was almost, you know, storybook ending for him. Nacho, I'll let you set this one off. Your thoughts on Jerome Bettis?
Now, see, this is, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years down the road, I'll be able to speak more in depthly on players. But like Junior, the same with Bettis. I saw the tail end of his career without, you know, going back and looking up certain things about Bettis. I couldn't tell you how he was with the Rams. All I know were the last few years with the Steelers, the Super Bowl victory, and things of that nature. So all I've ever seen from Jerome Bettis is greatness, so to speak. Him putting everything he can and will on the field to help his team win. Now, I know he is the cause of a fumble that could have cost them a Super Bowl, but, you know, it just everything else he put on the field, it was greatness in my eyes to see a big man like that dominate games, rush the ball like and sometimes he looked so graceful for a big man. It was just mind-boggling to me to watch someone that big be able to move like that. Now, it wasn't consistent and it wasn't all the time, but it was so often that, you know, it made me think, man, this guy is pretty good for a big guy. And the way he was able to dominate some games and take over and help out a young Ben in that team. It was just, in my eyes, like I said, I never got to see the early career of Jerome Bettis, so I couldn't tell you the overall consensus of his career. But for the last end part, from what I got to see firsthand, for me, it was nothing but greatness and deserves a jacket. So you're not going to hear me say anything ill will about Jerome. I think, you know, he just, from what I've seen and from what I can grasp from him on the field as a player and everything else, he deserves everything that he got.
Now, I hate to kind of say it like this, but I don't know about the graceful running. This boy is called the bus. This boy was trucking. purpose. Yeah. Like he didn't run around people. He didn't have no juke move. Everybody knew Jerome for one thing and one thing only, running straight and doing that bus move. What, you know, if he picked up a first down and scored a touchdown, especially in the latter part of his career. And the one thing that I feel, you know, awkward about, but I understand it, it especially when it's looking at it like it's kind of like the business, but also, and this is the rough part about it, them going with the younger talent. Jerome was only in St. Louis for a handful of years. I want to say 3 or 4 years, if I'm not mistaken. And then on came Marshall Faulk. So they had to make a move, whether to get, you know, keep the bus there or spill it to the career of Marshall Faulk. And, you know, Marshall spent a decent amount of time in Indianapolis. He came over from the Rams, and that's where the melee kind of happened. They went from one great running back to the next, and that ended up being the greatest show on turf while Marshall and Al Hakeem and Isaac Bruce and those boys got together. But, you know, the bus had to make that transition, getting to Pittsburgh and, you know, having great years of, you know, picking up the yardage that he did. He's in the top 10 in rushing yards in the NFL. For just like you said, a guy his size, he's in that conversation. So Jerome Bettis has done work, you know, respectfully throughout the NFL, and, you know, his time is deservedly so for him to get into the Hall of Fame. Chandler, your thoughts on Jerome Bettis, you know, your thoughts on his career, his speech, or whatever comes to mind.
Well, Jerome Bettis never played in St. Louis first. He was with the Los Angeles Rams for 3 years, and then they traded him. The Los Angeles Rams, the Rams organization, think about this, should have three running backs in the Hall of Fame. Marshall Faulk, Jerome Bettis. Actually goes Eric, Jerome, then Marshall.
Right.
Two of them they traded away. Two of them they didn't appreciate, which was Eric Dickerson.
And Jerome.
And Jerome Bettis. Now, Jerome Bettis was a graceful runner. If you saw him his first few years in the league, at his size, he could dance in the hole as well as anybody. The Rams did not like that. They wanted him to be basically a fullback. He's not a fullback.
Yeah.
He's a running back. Running back. Okay, but at his size, you know, Mike Allstott and guys like that, the Toby Gerhardts, the Mike Allstotts, they owe their careers to Jerome Bettis.
Right.
Jerome Bettis came along at a time when the league was looking at, okay, big guys play fullback, smaller guys play running back. And that's where the issue was in L.A. is they did not want him to be a running back, even though it was obvious anybody who ever watched him run the ball. The man was born to be a running back. So when he got to Pittsburgh, they said, hey, you're running back. Do you? You know, so he kind of blazed the trail for guys, you know, Mike Allstott of the world. Jerome, I used to love watching Jerome because I saw him with the Rams. The first time I ever saw him, I don't even remember who they were playing. I'm seeing this big dude. I'm like, okay, they're going to give it to the fullback, you know, because I'm used to guys of his size being a fullback. And he got the ball, and he hit the hole, and he did a two-step on the linebacker and dipped around him and was gone. And the announcer was like, oh, my God, do you see the speed? He said, he's not supposed to be able to run that fast. He's a fullback, you know. People kept getting surprised at the fact that Jerome Bettis had breakaway speed for a significant portion of his career. Once he would juke the first guy, run over the second guy, and then he could run away from you. People weren't used to seeing that. A guy his size with the skill set that he had, he was a throwback to Franco Harris. He truly was. And so he wound up with the right team. He wound up with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And if you look at Franco Harris, Franco Harris was really built similarly to Jerome Bettis. You know what I'm saying? So Jerome Bettis was a great running back. Was always a class guy. I'm glad he ended his career with a Super Bowl win. But the thing I'm gladdest about the most is that with some of the guys that got inducted this weekend, whether I agree with their induction or not, to see good guys be recognized for being good people. If you think about every single person that got inducted, save for one of the guys, not one ounce of controversy, not one DUI, not one fight, not one this, not one that. These guys all, like again, except for one, and we'll get to him, they all carry themselves the way we all wish we could. You know what I'm saying? They all conducted themselves in situations where maybe we couldn't. They conducted themselves better than most of us would, you know. Jerome Bettis had every right to kind of trash the LA Rams management with things going on. He never said a word. He never went to the papers. He never did any of that. You understand what I'm saying? When he got to Pittsburgh and towards the end of his career, when he still thought he could be a starting running back, and Kyle was like, no, you know, we're going to spot you in and this and that. We're going to mix with some of the younger guys. He could have raised his stick. He was Jerome damn Bettis. You know what I'm saying? How you gonna spot start me? I'm Jerome Bettis. You know, Emmitt Smith went to the Arizona Cardinals rather than put up with that. Tony Dorsett left the Cowboys rather than put up with that. Jerome Bettis said, okay, I'm going to do what's best for the team. So it's nice to see good guys get recognized for being good people. These guys are in the Hall of Fame, and Jerome Bettis is in the Hall of Fame not because he was such a great football player. And he was a great football player, one of the greatest running backs. I put him top 15 all time. But because he was a great person and human being. So congratulations to him.
Definitely. And looking at the situation, he was a part of that last year in Los Angeles. So he spent time in St. Louis for 1 year. The first 2 years he was in Los Angeles. But he ended up making that transition with them moving from L.A. to St. Louis. And after that year, that is when they made that move with him going to Pittsburgh and Marshall coming from Indianapolis and them, you know, moving forward with that one. But like I said, I still remember him in the backfield with Notre Dame, Lou Holtz and them, and Ricky Waters and guys like Tony Rice and those guys when they had that backfield in Notre Dame and him coming to the league in that given time. You just want to see those running backs make a big spill into the NFL. And a lot of, and that's another forgotten name while he was in college, being Ricky Waters. Ricky Waters was a running back that was with the Eagles and the 49ers as well. Just thinking about how that backfield was in college was amazing. But, you know, not to take too much away from the buzz, a.k.a. Jerome Bettis, and what he brought to Pittsburgh and going through year after year and, you know, that Super Bowl ring or Super Bowl championship eluding him so many year after year and being in front of teams like the Patriots, they finally figured it out and got it done with a young Ben Roethlisberger at that given time. And it was basically, I still remember how that thing ended and they were in the locker room and Ben was sitting there trying not to cry because he knew that they picked that winner. Well, they, you know, the motivational situation was for Jerome Bettis, and Jerome walked up on him and grabbed him, and Ben started crying, man. So, you know, those situations that I do remember about Jerome Bettis, man, I mean, awesome career from what I remember from college to the you know, the end of his career while he was with the Pittsburgh Steelers and picking up that championship in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. That was the year. The next player, another player seen as the totality of his career is Charles Haley, and out of his bust, too. He had the most on-target buzz, right? But his looked so fierce. It was like you didn't even want to walk next to it. Like his buzz looked like he really was on the field and about to hit somebody. And, you know, thinking about Haley's career, one of probably even that discussion to me, I'm going to say it like this. Off the edge, is just as good or great, let me say great, as Reggie White, Bruce Smith, you know, just to put him in those names, Haley's a part of five different Super Bowl championships. People don't even realize that. They always realize the quarterbacks like Bradshaw, Montana, and Brady picking up four. This guy's been with five different championship teams in his career. I want to speak on the behalf of Charles Haley. Your thoughts on he was going between rival and rival, being San Francisco 49ers and the Dallas Cowboys and picking up championships. Chandler, I'll let you set this one off about the career and the induction of Charles Haley.
Man, Charles Haley is a nut, first of all. The dude is you know, that joke, that story he told about the golfing, man, listen, I was there dying, okay? Because that story epitomized who Charles Haley was. He was a guy who did not give a damn. He was going to play football. He was going to play football hard all the time. If I remember correctly, I think he was actually traded for Ken Norton Jr. I think that was a trade. One of the worst trades the 49ers ever made. And Ken Norton Jr. was a really good linebacker, okay? Charles Haley was the difference maker on those two 49ers Super Bowl teams he was on. He was the difference on the defense by himself. Charles Haley, in my opinion, except for Lawrence Taylor, was the most disruptive defensive player ever. He was a guy who was as good as Lawrence Taylor before. He was Lawrence Taylor before Lawrence Taylor. He was that good. He could go. He was a defensive end slash linebacker. People don't know that. They think he was just a pass rusher. No, he stopped the run too. He started as a linebacker, which is why he got traded for Ken Norton Jr. This guy could stand up. He could put his hand in the dirt. You know, mm-hmm. He could come. He could line up over the center. He could line up over a tackle. He could line up over a guard. You know what I'm saying? You want to split that running back out of the backfield? If you want, Charles Haley's going to take his head off. He dealt with substance abuse issues, and one of the things is you know, I deal with mental health issues, and I'm glad he was open about the fact that he's trying to deal with mental health issues, that he's taking his meds. A lot of people are ashamed of that. It is what it is. If you have to take them, take them. I'm glad he took them before he got up there. Otherwise, that would have been all of his stories would have been blue. Okay, they probably would have had to tackle him and get him off the stage. but it's just nice to see that he has gotten his life together, that he's giving back to a lot of guys in this league, you know, Alden Smith, guys like that. There's a lot of guys that he's trying to help, you know, and reaching back and telling them his story. Charles, there was a lot of things with drugs in him, and, you know, I kind of think that was why the 49ers kind of got rid of him. I just think that people don't realize how great a player Charles Haley was. They truly don't. They truly don't realize. He's the only man in NFL history to have played on 5 championship teams. And fact that he went to the rival. At that time, the Niners and the Cowboys were the only two teams coming out of the NFC, man. At that time, it was either the 49ers or the Cowboys in the Super Bowl. And he got traded to the rival. Are you kidding me? Right. And still won. That doesn't happen. You don't get traded to the rival and then win 3 more rings. So it was just, you know what, it was good to see him getting there, and I'm glad he's doing much better with his life.
And also to add on to the situation that I didn't know that he was the only player in the NFL to have 5 championships or Super Bowl rings, if you will, but he is the only player that had 11 straight seasons as a defensive player to win 10 wins, 11 straight seasons. So that has to let you know what he was on the field as a defensive player, at least motivational-wise or bringing his nature of play to these teams. That's astonishing in itself. And this is all, you know, to the latter part of the 80s, getting into the 90s as well. If you've seen Haley, especially with that neck roll, you know his team was out there doing business or doing some type of work, and just knowing how he could be a interesting chess piece defensively that you had to worry about trying to match up, you know, linemen getting out of their stance and trying to deal with this guy through the havoc off the edge, especially just like Chandler said, from both defenses with the 49ers and, you know, the guys with Ronnie Lott and Bill Romanowski and them, and then getting with the Dallas Cowboys and getting in their little stint as well while they were tailing in their championships. From the step from 1992 to 1996. Nacho, your thoughts on Charles Haley? Danger on the field. I can't even think of like a big time word. We said everything possible about this guy. And he was one of those guys that took on your Packers at that given time, causing havoc in Texas and also in California, where the Niners were actually giving the Packers hell back then. But, you know, your thoughts on Charles Haley and him getting inducted into the Hall of Fame?
You know, you guys pretty much hit everything on the head, so I'll just go with a personal experience growing up in a household that was pretty much half Cowboys, half 49ers. For the first half of his career, you know, the 49ers, half of my family was all about him. And then when he got traded, it was the Cowboys half. So gotten to hear how sorry this guy is for 5 years and then how great he is for the next 5 years. It was kind of weird growing up because he was winning wherever he was going. So as a young kid, to me, he was always great because no matter where he was, regardless of the fan base, they loved him, especially when I saw the rival, which would be my other half of the family, hating him and despising him until he was on their team. So growing up, not having a bias on him by having a team at that age, just seeing how great of a player he is to make fans hate him so much. And then as soon as he's on their team, they're buying his jersey. They can't wait to get his autograph. They can't wait till he's near because he's such the best and he's the greatest player. And that's what the Hall of Fame is about. No matter where you go, other teams hate you, but they would love to have you on their team. And the moment you're on their team, you're the greatest player ever. So to me, he's well-deserving of this. The off-the-field issues, the locker room issues, whatever allegations or alleged incidents, I'm kind of one of those guys that, you know, none of them were really too bad for me. They had to do more with players and you know, dealing with coaches of that nature and other players and things like that. So I think, you know, necessarily he was winning and he was getting these guys on the field to do what they needed to do. I mean, now that he knows he had a problem and he's fixing that, there is a solution to that now. So I see that as a non-issue at all. But the on the field, like I said, he deserves every bit of that gold jacket.
Okay, now I don't know if I should actually kind of give some of these players a rest and kind of, you know, go, yeah, I will, because I can't wait to get into the thick of things about some of this stuff. But, Chandler, I want to ask you a question. I'm kind of group these two together, being Bill Polian and Ron Wolf, and knowing Polian's situation, at least for the duration of what I remember, was him being a guy upstairs for the Colts, and then me and Chandler had a brief discussion about him being a part of the Buffalo Bills situation while they were raising their hell in the AFC with, you know, guys like Thurman Thomas, Bill Kelly, those natures. But the Ron Wolf situation is very interesting to me, especially while we have Nacho here also. He was the guy responsible. Here it is. He's the guy responsible for getting Brett Favre from the Atlanta Falcons to the Green Bay Packers. Did not know that he was the guy that was behind that move to get him, you know, get Brett Favre out of Atlanta. Chandler, I'll let you spill into both of these guys. However you want to start, you can go Ron first or Bill first, however you like to. Your thoughts on these guys being pillars of the NFL, getting inducted to the Hall of Fame.
Well, we'll start with Ron Wolf since Nacho's here. And yeah, the Brett Favre trade, you know, Ron Wolf actually put his job on the line with that trade. He felt that confident. And if it hadn't worked out, he probably would have been fired. Now, and keep in mind that this man had been in football for 24 years with Al Davis. You know, he started out working with Al Davis in the Raiders. So that showed you why he has some strength of conviction. Because if you can last 24 years with Al Davis, you know what the hell you're doing, all right? listen, okay? And Al Davis was a brilliant man, was a brilliant football mind. So he learned from one of the best that's ever been around football. But, I mean, he started out, you know, with Al Davis for 24 years, was in the AFL, came over to the NFL. But then what he did in Green Bay to take on a challenge, and people don't remember, but Green Bay was trash when he got there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They were the laughingstock of the league. This is Title Town. This is Vince Lombardi. He's the Green Bay Packers, the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. Okay, and, you know, the stadium wasn't half full. You know, nobody wanted to play there. Go to Green Bay. Where the hell is that? Why the hell would I want to go there? Who the hell is Vince Lombardi? You know, that's how players felt about the Green Bay Packers. They were a joke. You know, they were the team that I drafted Tony Mandarich. Remember him?
Yeah.
I mean,
forever.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was at a time, really, and when the NFL needed that franchise to be good again. That was a time when the NFL truly needed the Green Bay Packers. They needed that franchise because the NFL, we can say we want about big market, small market, okay? The NFL is as good as the Green Bay Packers, okay? Because that's the team that really put the NFL on the map. And I know we can go back to Red Grains and da-da-da-da-da. The Vince Lombardi Packers truly were America's team because you everybody knew who Vince Lombardi was. People that don't know anything about football know the name Vince Lombardi. And they know the name Green Bay Packers. They couldn't tell you what a Green Bay Packer was. They couldn't find Green Bay on a map if you put a gun to their head. But they know that there's some town somewhere named Green Bay that a team called the Packers play there, and this guy Lombardi coached them. Okay? So Ron Wolf then resurrected that franchise. I'm not going to say he did it single-handedly, but he hired good people. You know, he got Reggie White to sign there. Nobody thought Reggie White was going to go to Green Bay. That was the biggest free agent signing in the history of the NFL for people that don't know. Seriously. Reggie White at that time could, listen, all 32 teams wanted Reggie. all of them. There was not one team that did not want to sign Reggie White. Not one. Think about that. All the free agents that we've seen, you know, we can talk about this guy. There's always some teams like, no, we're not going to go after him. Every single team in the National Football League made an offer to Reggie White. Every single one. And he chose Green Bay, Wisconsin. Okay? And the rest, you know, for Ron Wolf's history, he's a good guy. Everything I've ever heard about him, fans that have interacted with him, say he's a real self-deprecating guy, real classy guy. I know him and Bill Parcells are great friends. So congratulations to him for doing that. As far as Bill Polian, again, another guy that doesn't get enough credit for what he did. You know, people like to kill the Buffalo Bills, say you went to four Super Bowls, didn't win. How many teams have gone to four straight Super Bowls? I'll wait. Okay?
Yeah.
Look, how many players off of those Bills teams are in the Hall of Fame? We talk about the Steelers teams of the early was it, 70s and the Cowboys teams, and we talk about dynasties. Bill Polian built a dynasty in Buffalo. He built a dynasty in a little town in western New York that 9 months out of the year is covered in snow. And the 3 months is not covered in snow. There's still snow on the ground. It's just melting. All right? And he built a dynasty there, man. He built a dynasty there. And he did a great job. Then, of course, he went to Indianapolis. But to me, you know, the hiring of Marv Levy. Marv Levy was a guy no one would have ever thought could be a head coach. This guy was a professor in college, not a football coach. He was too smart. Bill Polian was like, you know what? I think he can coach. How'd that work out for him? You know, the Tony Dungy thing. If you look at the people that Bill Polian has drafted and signed and hired and put in management positions and turned into head coaches and assistant coaches, there's a laundry list of really great men that Bill Polian has either worked with, hired, or mentored. He said in his speech that the game gave him more than he gave the game. That's actually not true. His fingerprints are all over this version of the National Football League, and the fact that the league is so profitable is directly attributable to Ron Wolf and Bill Polian.
Okay, and looking more into before I get into the Polian situation, because I'm looking up some of Polian's information on his career, especially, you know, executive-wise. The Ron Wolf situation, he's drawing a little slack for, you know, running up on Roger Goodell saying way to go on the Brady situation. So I think he's actually supporting, you know, the NFL side and catching the Patriots or catching Brady, if you will, while they were, you know, I guess in that Deflategate manner situation. So Wolf is one of the guys that is, you know, they put the camera in front of him while he crossed paths with Roger Goodell and told him way to go kind of situation. So I think he's more in support of Roger Goodell trying to attack whether the Patriots or Tom Brady in that situation. So he's getting a little slack for that, you know, from the media, social media driven, what have you. But looking at Bill Polian's situation, I mean, his situation started in 78. He was a scout also, all the way from Kansas City and also, you know, teams in Canada as well. But I think this guy had an eye for talent, and especially after the stint that he had with the Buffalo Bills. He went to the Carolina Panthers and helped that organization get off the ground when it started in 95 also. You know, after 97, he gets into a situation with Indianapolis and then watched the career of Peyton Manning start up. So, you know, he was at the start of the Panthers organization getting off the ground and watching the Colts come back to strong relevancy outside of Peyton Manning. And that all ended in 2011. So he is definitely, like I said, a pillar. They both are. Let me not just say he is. They both are pillars / historians of the NFL. Nacho, your thoughts or any opinion toward Ron Wolf and Bill Polian in their careers in the NFL?
You know, Chandler already went on the greatness of Ron Wolf and how amazing that man is and all the great things he's done for Titletown and the 13-time NFL, 4-time Super Bowl champion, Green Bay Packers. So, you know, Ron Wolf's situation has been kind of covered. Bill Polian, on the other hand, I hear a lot of people, like you said, he got there at the start of when Peyton Manning got there pretty much, and they couple Peyton Manning as for the success of the Colts. And not so much Bill Polian. But if you recall, yesterday we were speaking on Chandler was speaking a little bit on Peyton Manning yesterday. Now he needs a perfect team. He needs a perfect system. He needs everything to be almost perfect around him to be successful. And that's what Bill Polian did. Peyton Manning went out there and did the X's and O's on the field, while Bill Polian did the background and put an entire team around him that was successful, that could do what he needed to do, that the team that he put around him was able to do what Peyton needed them to do at any given time for them to be successful. Yes, Peyton was there for the X's and O's, but without the team that Polian put around him for many, many years that he put together to put on the field, the coaching staff that he put out there to guide these men on the field week in and week out, that was all Bill Polian. So, yes, you can put some of the X's and O's wins on Peyton Manning, but without the team, without the decisions he made, without the trades, without getting the players in there that they needed, following up a Marvin Harrison with a Reggie Wayne, things of that nature, those are things that get overlooked. And those are the things that people don't really pay attention to when they see Peyton Manning and they think, oh, Peyton Manning is the reason why the Colts won. Without the team that he was around, that was around him, I don't think they would have done just as well. Peyton, like Chandler said, Peyton needs a system and a team around him that fits him perfectly. And Bill Polian did that to a T for 13 plus years.
Okay. So, you know, just like I said, the people are going to read more into this, especially as of today, as the day goes on. They're going to, you know, interview these guys and get, you know, memories of these guys in their NFL career. Today, you know, individually interview these guys alongside of the game that's going to take place today, which we'll be talking about. But like I said, I wanted to give the players a break. Now I want to get back to them, and I think Chandler's going to start this fire up first. I'm not going to let anything sit back any longer. The induction of Tim Brown, getting into the Hall of Fame, and I'll see how he feels about this one. This is a very interesting one that I want to hear about it. Watch him get into the league as well, coming from Notre Dame also. An established wide receiver, one of the more recognizable names at the position. But Chandler, your thought? No, you know what, Nacho, I'll come to you. Your thoughts on Tim Brown, his induction and his speech as well in Canton, Ohio.
You know, I didn't get to see Tim Brown's speech. I was never really a fan of Tim Brown, so I never really watched him on the field. If you want to go to Chandler to set this fire off, I'm not a the guy doesn't really strike me as a Hall of Famer, so I'm not really impressed by this pick, and I didn't really even take the time to look him up.
Okay, Chandler, well, your thoughts on Tim Brown and why everybody has a beef with him getting into the Hall?
Well, okay. I've never thought Tim Brown was a Hall of Famer. Now, why I had nothing to do last night sitting in the car, so I'm on my phone, I'm looking at the NFL Network, and they start talking about, you know, doing the Tim Brown story, his challenges and adversities and making it to the Hall of Fame. Tim Brown played with 22 quarterbacks. 22. Played with 22 quarterbacks.
That's terrible.
22 quarterbacks. He, after his second season, Al Davis said, you're only going to be a third down receiver, and he didn't see the field on first and second down for 2 years. He still wound up with 1,000 catches. He led the league in receptions. He led the league in punt return yards. He led the league in kick return yards. He's the only man who's ever done that. These are all great things. I still don't think he's a Hall of Famer. I watched Tim Brown his entire career. He was a really, really – he was a great receiver. He's not a Hall of Fame receiver. He's not a Hall of Fame receiver. He wasn't – I don't remember one moment for Tim Brown. I don't remember one. And that's not saying he didn't have any. I don't remember him. I can tell you a John Stallworth moment. I can tell you a John Taylor moment. You know, some wide receivers in the Hall of Fame, give me some. I can tell you a moment. I can tell you a Lance Allworth moment. Okay? I can tell you
Hell, I can tell you a Keyshawn Johnson moment.
Can't tell you a Tim Brown moment.
He didn't leave that type of impact to me. There's nothing memorable about his career. Other than the fact that he played with 22 quarterbacks.
But do you put that on a situation of him playing with so many different quarterbacks and still being able to go out there and put up these numbers? I mean, he has his some of his stats are historic. He does not as a receiver though, but he has some
right.
stats that you do have to recognize with.
But see, that's the thing. As a kick returner or punt returner, if you want to put him in the hall for that, I could probably see an argument for that. His first 5 years, he averaged 30 catches a season. His first 5 years. Not 70, not 60, not 50, not 40, but 30. I hate to be LeBron here,
Was it Schrader his quarterback at that time?
Dude, at that time, his first five seasons, he had five different quarterbacks.
Right. You're right.
So it depends on the moment of who was throwing to him. And I get all of that. My point is this, man. He doesn't move the needle for me. He doesn't move the needle for me. I think that Tim Brown got into the Hall of Fame because of who he is as a person, not because of who he was as a player. I honestly do. I honestly do. And after having listened to him speak and seeing the interviews and all of that, you know what? I can understand the sentiment to put him in because of the stuff that he went through with Al Davis and how the Raiders treated him because he's a really good guy and all of those things. I get all of that. But I'm never going to tell you that Tim Brown doesn't make my top 30 all time.
Interesting. And that is something that we could probably put together a sideshow, you know, and thinking of, you know, I guess top 30, top 50 receivers. Because I want to see who that list would be. We'll do that someday because that is interesting, especially with what Tim Brown went through and all of the quarterbacks that he dealt with. I think the one consistent quarterback that he had was Rich Gannon that gave him a good time on the field, and they actually got out there and got to a Super Bowl, no less, and fell heavily short in front of that Tampa Bay team. But that's the only quarterback I can really recognize with Tim Brown. And while they had a decent core around them with Jerry Porter and Jerry Rice as well, and they fell short in that Super Bowl where everybody knows it looked like Tampa Bay defense dominated the entire that game there.
Ty, real quick.
Yeah.
Here's why he's not a Hall of Famer for me. I'm going to give you a name that started ahead of him for two seasons. Mervin Fernandez. Anybody remember him besides his family?
Right. Nah, I don't have any recollection of
that. Was deemed a better starting wide receiver than Tim Brown. And had Mervin Fernandez not torn his knee up, Tim Brown would not be in the Hall of Fame because he was going to be a third down receiver. So you're going to tell me that you couldn't beat out Mervin Fernandez, but you're a Hall of Famer? Really?
Hey, at that given time, I mean, that. I guess that was the discussion. But right now, I mean, he still moved on. He did enough work in his career to be a difference in the AFC to make 9 different Pro Bowls. So I mean, he has to be doing something to be recognized at that position, no? 9 of them?
A kick returner, punt returner, yes. Not as a wide receiver. If you look at his numbers, the majority of his all-purpose yards come from kick returning and punt returning. If you think about any most of his memorable moments, it's either on a kick return or a punt return, Ty.
True.
The guy's
true
a special
that.
Team player. You put him in the Hall of Fame as a wide receiver.
That's my problem. Okay. We split hairs if he should be in as a kick returner or a wide receiver. Well, like I said, I want to set up a separate show one day down the line, and I want to do it before the season starts up. I don't want to do it in the thick of things of the season. But I do want to pick his brain on at least 30 receivers. Because Andre Reed is in that discussion too, you know. Andre Reed is in the Hall of Fame also. So, and not to say anything bad about Andre Reed, because Andre Reed did work, and he was a part of that four-time AFC winning championship team. They won at the AFC 4 different times, but I want to see this list, but Tim Brown got in there, and I knew this was something that triggered Chandler, because we spoke about it in the green room also, how he did not like the fact that Tim was in here. I wanted to hear his stuff. Another name that I don't remember, but I've read up on his situation, is Mick Tinglehoff, an offensive lineman for the Minnesota Vikings. He was a part of that team in the 70s, and they actually had a good stint of wins while he was there also. Chandler, your thoughts on Mick Tinglehoff getting into the Hall of Fame and your knowledge and recollection of him being in the NFL as well?
Well, this is why I always have Fran Tarkington in my top five.
Right.
Fran Tarkington is a lot of things. Sometimes he's crass, and sometimes he needs to shut up. Yesterday was perfect, what he said. Mick Tinglehoff was 6'2" and played center in the NFL for, I want to say, was it 16 straight seasons? He didn't miss. He played 240 straight games at center. Never missed a game, never missed a practice. At 6'2", 200-and-something pounds, he played center. Okay? He played up against guys named Nitschke and Butkus. Those guys. Okay? He took those guys on. He played in front of a quarterback who literally he would never know where the quarterback was, because all Fran did was run around back there, okay?
Yeah, he was scramble.
Okay. He might have been blocked about four times because Fran kept running back behind him, all right? I think it took too long, personally. I don't like the fact that a lot of players from that era get overlooked. And now we want to induct them when they're gone. Because if he was good enough to be in the Hall of Fame now, then he was good enough to be in the Hall of Fame 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You know, man, what, 37 years it took you to realize that this man was good?
Mm-hmm.
It took you 37 years? But you know what? I'm glad his family and his kids got to see it. And I'm just, you know what? I really, really wish that some of these younger football fans would realize that football was played at a time before Xbox and PlayStation and John Madden. Okay? There was football before that. All right?
Right.
The guys were really good. And the measure of how good they were, look at the size of guys and how they played every game and played with single bar face masks and all those kinds of things. And look at some of the statistics and the things these guys did. Okay? Football didn't start in the 90s, people. It didn't start in the 90s. All right, so good for the team family, and congratulations to them.
Nacho, anything that you'd like to add toward the Tinglehoff induction? Him out of our rival division. At that time, it was called the NFC Central, but now it's the NFC North.
You know, just the only thing that, you know, we mentioned the four straight appearances by the Bills. He was part of four different appearances over an 11-year span with 10 divisional crowns. So, not only were they doing it, they were doing it over a long span of time, him and Tarkington. It wasn't 4 or 5, 6 years. It was over a 10, 11-year span that they were dominating a division that was, you know, it is what it is at that point. So one of the best in the league. So those guys deserve every bit of credit. Even though they took four losses, they still got there, and they were consistently winning that division.
An interesting stat that he had that I'm looking at right now from his career, too. He is number two in most consecutive games played in the NFL, in the history of the NFL, behind his teammate. This is somebody my father loved, even though my father was a Redskins fan, but he was a big Jim Marshall fan. You can tell me all about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall was number one with 270 games played, and he was right behind him, being Mick Tinglehoff with 240. So, goes to show the durability of these players back then, and playing probably with all of the injuries listed. And he is one of the, you know, select few players that has a number retired in the Ring of Honor in Minnesota as well. So that, you know, it speaks volumes. And the one thing that Chandler did hit on, that he had to wait this long to get into the Hall of Fame, 32 years after he was eligible to get in there. And that is the one thing that does bother me, too, when they, you know, see a guy pass on, and it's like, okay, let's get him in there, you know, to recognize him now. They should be able to get in there. But it all depends off these voters. And y'all already know, people around Sports City know how I feel about these doggone voters. But that's just me. That's a personal aspect toward these guys. Last but not least, Yes, sir.
And I know Chandler said he was 6'2", and somebody's probably thinking, well, he's 6'2". He could still be a hefty guy at 6'2". He was 6'2", 237. By comparison, the Viking center now is 6'4", 310. Just think about that for a second. Like Chandler said, not only was he short at 6'2", but he was also under 240 pounds, starting 240 straight games. It's ridiculous.
6'2", 235 is the size of an NFL running back. Just think about that. Okay. Last but not least, before we start running into a lot of the other topics that we have left, because we are the last third of the show, is Will Shields. And this is a guy that I've seen come into the league from college and be a historian to me with that Kansas City Chiefs organization, playing up front, one of the more recognizable offensive linemen for this Chiefs team, was getting to a handful of Pro Bowls, one of the guys that sat up there and blocked for guys like Marcus Allen and stuff like that. And this was after Marcus Allen got traded from the Raiders to Kansas City. Let's start this one off. Nacho, your thoughts on Will Shields getting inducted into the Hall of Fame for the Kansas City Chiefs?
You know, I don't go that far back. I do go far enough back to have watched him block for Priest Holmes in a span of a few years. I think Priest Holmes, with Shields there running the job, he was about 4,000 yards over four seasons, a little over 4,200 yards. So I was able to, during that span, I was playing football and playing a similar position on the offensive line. So I was watching him lead Priest Holmes blow massive holes towards the end of his career, and just being able to watch him do that. He was in Hall of Famer for me, so I was unable to watch him early in his career. I was unaware of offensive linemen and their importance to the game before that. So I just didn't watch him that much growing up. But you know, from what I watched when he did what he did for Priest Holmes and blowing those big holes, so he could just blow right through them and run for 67 yards down the field. It was a beauty to watch, especially as a young offensive lineman myself.
And speaking of Priest Holmes, I wish he could have extended that career, but, his stint with his concussion situation shortened his career. I would have loved to see him be able to play to his full extent. Well, he did give his full extent. He just was, not healthy enough or able to go out there and help that Kansas City Chiefs team. And he was actually from the Chiefs and also the Ravens as well, but that's a whole other situation. I don't want to take too much away from Will Shields. I think he spent over 13 years with the Kansas City Chiefs. Chandler, your thoughts with Will Shields getting inducted to the Hall of Fame?
Orlando Pace is not in the Hall of Fame. That's my thought on Will Shields. He ain't better than Orlando Pace. Okay? I'm sorry. Will Shields ain't no damn Hall of Famer. He's
wow.
not. Okay, Orlando Pace isn't in the Hall of Fame. Will Shields is. Are you kidding me? Will Shields. Come on, son. And you guys know that when these things came out, I had a problem with Will Shields getting in. I still got a problem with it. I'm sure he's a really nice guy. I'm sure he was a really good offensive lineman. He don't belong in the damn Hall of Fame.
I'm actually looking up if Pace is eligible, and he is. So you are correct there. I don't know. I recognize him coming into the league, especially coming out of college. And like I said, he spent 13 years there, and he's been in front of, big-time running backs. Like I said, Marcus Allen, you could also throw Priest in there, just like Nacho hit on as well. He's been to he has a ton of accolades in his career from spanning from 95 on up to when he retired in 2006. He no less was an all-pro, a second-team all-pro when he retired, too. So, it's tough for linemen to get recognized, especially at the offensive tackle position, at least Orlando Pace, but this guy was an interior lineman being a guard. So, Shields, you got a little heat in the kitchen. I'm trying to defend you because I actually know about the lineman position, playing in the trenches with the Hawks, and the work that you were able to do, making 12 different – he made 12 Pro Bowls in his NFL career. Like, that's astonishing in itself, at least to me. That's something that I can recognize. Say that again?
It's 12 straight Pro Bowls, like year after right. year after year.
Okay, there's hey. Other offensive linemen who made double-digit Pro Bowls year after year. Oh, and by the way, we all know that after a while, a Pro Bowl, once you've gone on a couple, people just kind of pencil your name in. Okay.
Right, true. That's true, too.
So let's yeah. not act like, you know, going to the, you know, you can go to Pro Bowl and not have a great season. All right? Alan Faneca, guy went to multiple Pro Bowls. There's a whole lot of offensive linemen from that time period that were doing good things that had great running games. All right? I get people like Will Shields. I don't know why. I don't know why this love affair with Will Shields all of a sudden. But I'm sorry, man. The dude's not a Hall of Famer. He's not. He was a good interior lineman. He was good. Pretty good. I'll give you pretty good. But last I checked, there were four other guys on the offensive line. He's the reason Priest Holmes. He was the only one blocking? I'm sorry. Was he the only one blocking? I seem to remember Joe Montana getting lit up back there. He was in front of Joe Montana. Okay, I seem to remember Joe Montana getting lit up back there. All right, you want to bring up Marcus Allen? Let's bring up Joe Montana. All right? Stop it.
But it's not even a disagreement. It's a debate. I like it. We'll read more into this. And I think Orlando Pace will end up getting in there. He was eligible as of last year. He's eligible as of last year. So, and Noah Shields has been out of the league since 06. He's waited 9 years. So I understand they could have got Pace in there as a first year, you know, first ballot Hall of Famer. That could have presented itself because Pace was a monster. At the tackle position. We'll see, but, you know, Shields waited, you know, his time. And this is based off of all of these writers, man, and the voters that vote these guys in. This is nothing that we can do. We have no hand in the situation. We just have to sit back and wait till they come up with the nominations and see how they vote these guys in. But right now, Chandler has a grief or a beef with Tim Brown and Will Shields getting into the hall. The call number is 917-889-9592. I want to get into this epic Sunday because football is back, people. Football is back, even though there's some stuff going on in the baseball world, especially with my boys getting slapped around yesterday. I'm still hurt and pissed off how that went down yesterday. But before I get into the game today, I want to see how you two feel about the brawl that happened between the Houston Texans and the Redskins, and if people are really dialing into this too much. And this happens every single season with, you know, two teams, regardless of who it may be. I think last year it was the Texans and the Broncos. Again, the Texans again, and the Texans are at it with the Redskins. However, at the Redskins scrimmage situation, they had people that were on the sideline that were not a part of the team but wearing a jersey if they weren't in pads. In the midst of this fight, swinging and throwing blows, no less. But like I said, are people really reading into this too deep? Because it happens every season. Every season these two teams meet for scrimmages. You know, it's summertime, it's hot out, they're worn down from grueling, you know, practices or what have you, and they end up scuffling or getting into a fight or what have you. Are people reading into this situation? Now, this is how I had the question presented today at the brunch. Nacho, I'll start with you first. And they're thinking that what sparked the situation was because J.J. Watt consistently, you know, brings it. He doesn't take a play off. He's giving it 110% every snap. And they're thinking that this could have, you know, ruffled some feathers and got these guys going and spilled into another play. And they had everybody from the Texans organization and the Redskins organization out there, pushing, shoving, and they're throwing punches. Your thoughts on this brawl that happened in their scrimmage?
I mean, if they don't like what J.J. Watt's doing, then stop him from doing it. This is a practice, and you got to go all out. Now, the thing I see is no problem at all. What's going to happen if they throw a blow? What's going to happen if they get into a fight? Is a flag going to get thrown? Is a penalty going to be assessed? Is a fine going to be processed? No, you can do whatever you want. This is the do what you want and get away with it, card. As long as you don't pull out a weapon or something, do what you want to get away with the time period. This is a practice. And these teams are practicing each other day in and day out and can't go that extra little bit because it is your teammate, because it is somebody you're going to see tomorrow, because it is someone you got to see week in and week out. But when you're practicing against another team that you're only going to be practicing for with a couple times, and then you won't even see them again, and in some cases you won't even play them
throughout the year at all, why not just go ahead and you know what, J.J. Watt's getting a little crazy. Let's just show him, you know, whatever. If he gets a little crazy again, you know, whatever have you, they got a little overboard. It doesn't really bother me. It's not a big issue. Like I said, there's no flags. There's no penalties. These games don't mean anything. They're not even games. They're practices. Like you said, it's just something that happens year in and year out with social media, with the smartphones, with everyone having access to videotape and upload at any given time, any given place, at anywhere. You're almost instantly involved. Sometimes these practices are even live streamed by people from their phone. So you're going to see everything instantaneously. As we're even 10, 15 years ago, we would have read about this maybe next week or maybe even Monday or Tuesday. It wouldn't have been anything in the headlines because it would have been an everyday occurrence that these beat writers and these people usually see every day. Now they have to pick it up, or else, you know, somebody else will, and they'll run with it. So it's just how it is this day and age. You have to talk about something. It's so dull. You have to get those viewers and you have to get those likes, and that's how you have to do it nowadays. So any story is a story, and especially if there's fighting. And now it gives, you know, the mothership an opportunity to interview J.J. Watt about a brawl that he actually has no problem with, which I have no problem with. It's practice. I mean, again, do we constantly have to reiterate Allen Iverson? I mean, we're talking about practice. But, you know, it's what we got to do to fill up this dead space.
And interesting enough, an interesting thing that Nacho said, right? And not to say, like, I want them to just turn absolute renegade and start bringing this into the regular season, but they're going to get into fights like this in the off season or training camps or preseason, so on or what have you. But if they do it in the field of play in the regular season, they get a flag thrown to get ejected and fined or what have you. But this situation doesn't present itself in, you know, a scrimmage. They don't throw a flag or whatever. They try to break it up, and hopefully these guys can go out there and continue to go at battle for however long the duration is. And sometimes, especially while it was going on, they said that the coaches may end up ending the scuffle, but you don't see the you know, the end of the whole practice ordeal, if you will. But, Chandler, your thoughts on the brawl between the Texans and the Redskins? Did it go too far? Are people reading into this too much? Especially with these rules that happen every single season in training camp.
No, didn't go too far. Yes, people are making much ado about nothing. It's a tempest in a teapot. I don't care. This happened last year where some fans got involved. It happened the year before that. It was a Dolphins joint practice with somebody. Was it 2-3 years ago where somebody got into some lady hitting the guy with her shoe, I think, if y'all remember. So who cares? You know, who cares? They got into a fight in practice. So what? They're supposed to. They're not teammates. Let's not forget that for some of these guys in this practice, they're fighting for a spot on the roster. So their intensity level is through the roof. Okay, because they're worried about getting cut right after this practice. So I don't have a problem with it. Fight on.
And to that point, and sorry, don't mean to cut anyone off, but to that point, Chandler, you said these guys are fighting for a job, and Todd just said J.J. Watt's going 110. You want to match that intensity, and not anyone can or be, you know, he's one of a kind. We all talk about Grady, but this is practice, and these young guys and everyone else wants to match his intensity. So imagine you got every single other player on the offensive line trying to be as intense as J.J. Watt against somebody on the defense who isn't as intense, or vice versa with the defense and offense. So then you've got that resonates through the trenches when you've got one player who's just going, you know, balls to the walls hard as possible, and it just resonates through that O-line. And some of them get it, and some of them don't. And sometimes the ones that don't get a little angry that they keep getting beat by this rookie, or something happens, and then they take it out on J.J. or whatever, what have you. So you have to take that into effect, too, and you can get mad, and Ty said, yeah, like Ty said, you're not going to get a flag, so why not? And I believe this practice did end after the big brawl
But I think if the sideline contestants or the sideline people, if they wouldn't have gotten involved at all and it was just the team practice, like you said, Ty, would have just kept going on as normal.
Right. So, like I said, hopefully they could. I don't know how they channel this, but they have to get a feel for, you know, being at game speed, you know, before they get into the preseason games, at least. They're going to have a battle, you know, whether they get into the heat of the moment and start throwing blows. It just bothered me that they had somebody on the sideline that wasn't. For me, it didn't look like he was a player or a part of the front office out there, you know, pushing and shoving players from the other team and throwing blows or what have you. So, you know, that was something that drew question to me. And like I said, every single season we're going to have at least one of those outbreaks where they're going to end up swinging, punching, and you know, it's a bunch of men competing for spots or competing for a job for at least August to January or February, however far the team may take them. So this is something that I wanted to bring up as a topic. And right before we get into the main topic, or at least the quote-unquote main event of this Sunday for now, even though it's preseason, the game, the Hall of Fame game, we have football on slate, the Minnesota Vikings up against the Pittsburgh Steelers today. What will we be watching out for? Some of the players that are, you know, that have gotten drafted and seeing if these guys can have a good output in the time that they're out there on the field. I want to hear your thoughts on this game. Football is back, especially on a Sunday where we get to put this on our plates here at the brunch. Nacho, I come to you first. Your thoughts on the Steelers and the Vikings going at it today. Which players will you be watching out for? And seeing if any of these guys go past the series or two, offensively or defensively.
From what I've been reading and what I've been watching, it doesn't look like Big Ben or Antonio Brown or any of these starting players will actually play. So for me, it'll just be, you know, rookies upon rookies. And like I said, interestingly enough, defensively, I think Pittsburgh, to see what they do without Dick LeBeau, to see how they play, to see how the schemes are run, to see where players are placed, I think Dick LeBeau did an excellent job with where he put players in certain positions and how he used them and put their skills to the best use. You know, it's one thing to sit there and watch and to try to learn someone do that, but to get a feel for that and to know what certain players are good at and to know what certain players are excellent at and to put them in the right position at the right time, that takes another skill in of itself. And we all know how many years Dick LeBeau was in the league and how well he honed that skill. So I'm just interested in to see what the defensive philosophy will be for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And as for the Minnesota Vikings, I believe they're not going to put AP out there this game. This is, you know, the very first game in a five-game series for both these teams. They get five games this preseason. So this will be similar to me as the fourth or their fifth game in the preseason. And we won't see too much of the starters. So I'm very much interested in the rookies and all those players and how it needs to go. There's no players in particular I'm interested in seeing. I just want to see, like I said, what defensively Pittsburgh has to offer and what they'll be trying to do and put out there on the field. And as for Minnesota, I just want to see just what they've got to offer as it pertains to their bench, their backups, and what they're going to be putting on the field majority of the game as it pertains to, you know, second positions and whatnot. Because I think that's what they'll be trying to practice more with, those second-string players. Those players, I think, will play most of the game, and they're going to be trying to get those guys the most experience to add up to what they've already got. With the veteran leadership of AP coming in at the running back position is what they kind of needed last year, someone that could solidify that run game so Teddy could have the time he needed to throw passes and sometimes the ability just to hand off. So just to see what the Vikings do, how they run those second-string players, I think it'll be a little interesting. But as the first game in the preseason, I'm just glad football's back and that I get to see some live pads and some live action for at least a little bit.
And it's going to be interesting. Probably not as this game here, but down the road, at least in week three, on how this Pittsburgh Steelers defense is going to look, one, without Vic LeBeau any longer, and then two, the interesting thing, no more Troy Polamalu back there. That is going to be the more interesting thing to see this team without their, I guess, their high-spirited safety back there, if you will. So I do want to see how Blitzburg looks moving forward. But definitely we get there, at least get our NFL juices flowing. Chandler, your thoughts on the game today? Minnesota, you probably will see Bridgewater, maybe, depending on how many snaps he gets, if he gets past a series or so. And also for Pittsburgh, a lot of the names that will be out there fighting for a position. Also, I don't know if we will be seeing Le'Veon Bell or not, especially with the season that he had last year and how it ended for him, if he can get back out there and show like he still has that burst right now in preseason. But your thoughts on this matchup? We have football here on the 9th of August.
If you want to watch a game where you're going to see third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round draft picks playing basically the entire game, where you won't see not one star player, then knock yourself out. That's what this game is. This game, if you see Teddy Bridgewater in for more than two snaps, I'll be shocked. I doubt you'll see any player of note on the field. It's a glorified scrimmage to me.
Right. Well, true. And like I said, you know, a lot of people, especially, like I said, they've been coming to our Gmail and saying, thank God you guys are back in football mode. They want to get back out here. I definitely wanted to get that out there and see how we felt about it. But, you know, these are two teams that people have to watch out for. And one, and depending on if he does get out there or not, I know he would probably try to take advantage of this and go up top for something. But this is where it all started for Mike Wallace for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And how he looks in camp already, I've seen him, you know, blow the doors off of a couple coverages that they put against him. So if he can beat that defense for one pass early, similar to when T.O. moved to the Eagles in the first play of the preseason that they played, Donovan threw him an 80-yard bomb. So that could present itself, too, if they could get one to Mike Wallace to go up top on the Pittsburgh Steelers, especially with no Troy Polamalu back there, too, would be interesting in itself. So this is something that I'm looking forward to and seeing if they could get out there, especially seeing how Minnesota's offense is going to progress, I mean, into the next season after they had a questionable season and trying to build off of what they can get the best efforts out of a guy like Teddy Bridgewater. Like Chandler said, if he's there and able to give it a go, I don't see him getting past the series because they always do that. And most of the times when he's out there, majority of these starting quarterbacks, when they're out there for the series, they hand the ball off three times and they end up punting. So it's interesting to see if they will get him out there. I know it's probably a situation where they'll probably sit Big Ben. They don't want to get their franchise quarterback out there hurt. But just to see these teams line up, go out there, give it their all right now. Well, at least these guys fighting for position battles and hearing, hey, well, this receiver did this running back did that, or, you know, this linebacker came up and committed, made a good play. Just to hear that type of conversation, I got goosebumps right now. I got goosebumps right now, ready to see some action out there on the gridiron, that's for sure. Anything else?
You get goosebumps thinking about that bum Mike Wallace running the only route he knows how to run. Really.
I feel like speed. I like speed. He runs the ball too. Keep up with him.
He's a bum. How many balls did he drop in Miami when he was wide open? How much complaining did he do? And the only route he can run is a go route. Third organization, Ty. His third organization.
True.
Okay?
That's true.
He went to Miami, was supposed to be the number one receiver, and couldn't and refused to learn any routes other than a freaking Z route. Are you serious?
Would you take him in New York?
Hell no.
He said hell no.
Not if he played for free. Not if he played for free. I told you this, and I'm going to say it again. The Minnesota Vikings made a mistake bringing Mike Wallace to that team. There's a reason Pittsburgh got rid of him. Because does he have talent? Absolutely. Did the Pittsburgh Steelers need talented wide receivers besides Antonio Brown? Of course they do. Think about that for a minute. It wasn't that they let him go. They helped him pack, and they held the door for him when he left.
Right. Hey. I would love that speed on I'm situated now. Like, the Lions have a good receiver core right now. But before Golden State and them boys got there, shoot, I would take Mike Wallace. I would. I'm not going to lie. This guy had good seasons with Big Ben. They had good seasons together, especially when him and Antonio figured it out on how to make that work. Antonio was doing a lot of the stuff underneath with Heath, and Wallace would, you know, take that secondary with him. So, I mean, it helps quarterbacks that can pick you apart. With this guy, and I think this is something that Bridgewater is going to have to work with, especially right now at the start of preseason, or seeing if they do get out there in this game. But we'll see. We have 8 hours before we get ready to see a kickoff. I mean, this is interesting that I get to say kickoff and stuff like that, picked off, sack. Oh, we're back to that type of talk, man. Sports City, we're back in gridiron form. We had the gridiron show yesterday. And give you a full taste of the Hall of Fame weekend, that's for sure. But we are at the tail end of the show. I need plugs and closeouts from the both of you on an epic brunch to open up the month of August. Nacho, I'll let you set this one off first. Plug, promo, anything that you like to get off your chest here in the kitchen at the brunch.
At Nacho in the Box, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's going to be an amazing season for everyone, I think, as horrible. As we will see some teams, and as great as we will see some teams, it's going to be amazing for us fans to watch the total downfall of some teams and the rise of other teams that we didn't even expect or that we did expect. So I'm just excited that football's on tonight. I am going to watch the game. I'm not looking for players or looking for anything special. I just want to see some live action football for a little bit. Get my fix. And then go watch some baseball and get ready for this October baseball coming up. I'm really excited. I did have a couple questions for Chandler and Utah. I guess you can, on your closeouts, get them answered for me. Are the Mets and the Toronto Blue Jays heating up at the right time to take those divisions from those division, leaders right now? The way that they've been playing and then the way that the bats have heated up for both teams, is this the way of the AL and the NL East? Again, you guys have been great. You let me come on. I'm so glad football's back in the discussion, and we still got some great baseball coming up too, guys. So I'm excited to watch some of this great baseball coming up towards the end of September and October.
Okay, definitely, Chandler. To answer his question about the Blue Jays and the Mets, and also a plug and closeout as we shut down the brunch.
Well, the Mets are peaking, and the Nationals are choking dogs again. I still say that the reason is the manager, because that team is far too talented to be playing the way they're playing. The Mets gave their fans, something they haven't given their fans in 20 years, which is trade deadline acquisitions and good players. They didn't just go out and get some bums. They got some good players. Cespedes is a good player. I'm not a fan of the Kelly Johnson thing, but he is a decent utility guy. Juan Uribe is good to come up with a big hit clutch situations. So the Mets actually did a good job with their acquisitions. I mean, the Blue Jays are the Blue Jays. They've always been able to hit. I know they got David Price. They still don't have enough pitching. I don't believe in the Blue Jays. I never will, because I don't believe in John Gibson. And I know that Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion both are going to be hurt before the end of the season. They are both going to miss at least 2 weeks apiece, because they always do. And that's just a fact. Now, they've made some interesting acquisitions. They just picked up Cliff Pennington yesterday, but Cliff Pennington is not that great. So I think if the Blue Jays take the division, it'll be more a result of the fact that Brian Cashman failed to do his job than it was that the Blue Jays did anything spectacular. This is going to come down to whether Yankee starting pitching can give them length. If the Yankee starting pitching can give them length, then the Yankees will win the division, because the bullpen will be rested. If the starters keep going six innings, then the bullpen will be exhausted by the end of August, and the Yankees will not even be in a wild card. With that, it's Night Channel 7 on Twitter. Always a lot of fun. Stop rushing my damn summer away. It's August. Baseball.
I'm sorry. There's a football game tonight, though. So I'm sorry you feel that type of way. listen, it is slowly counting down for you, for us, for baseball-wise. But this is actually a good run for baseball, especially, with this is the final stretch before everybody starts trying to get their engine started for the month of September for the baseball race and seeing if they could win their division or fight for their wild card position. So this is great. And for me to answer the situation, Nacho, I think the Blue Jays are on complete fire. I don't even know what other word to use. And especially, okay, they just won back-to-back games against the Yankees, right? The Blue Jays are usually and historically terrible in the middle of the Bronx. They do not play well against the Yankees in New York. They just won a 2-1 game Friday, and they just shut the Yankees out at home. They historically do not play well in Yankee Stadium, the new one or the old one. So that speaks volumes on where the Blue Jays are headed. If these guys can stay healthy, I don't want Chandler trying to, you know, clip their wings and saying that these guys are going to end up hurt. So I want to see what type of run Toronto can get on, because they're playing some good ball, off to a great streak. They've won 10 or 11 games straight since Tula Whiskey's been there. They have not lost since they got Troy in the building. So this is big for them. The Mets, especially if this pitching staff can stay together, they can stay healthy. Man, the sky's the limit for them in the National League. I think the one team that can stand in front of them is St. Louis Cardinals. I think that'll be an epic battle. And knowing how these guys have actually gone at it in years past in the postseason, and the Mets falling short, it would be interesting to see if the Mets can outdo the St. Louis Cardinals, especially while they're pitching and has a little bit of confidence, and they're starting to get pieces back also, and hopefully David Wright can do something if he can add it. If they do get him a part of what they got going, I think they actually leave him off the roster and rock with what they got, unless they can do something different. But we'll see how this does pan out. Baseball is still here. I ain't rushing this summer, but you only got 22 days left of August, and then September is here, so I could care less what you can do in September. We all love September, because that's basically when all the big-time sports come back around, that's for sure. SportsCityChefs.com. Check out the website, the interviews, the blog, the chefs. Any questions that you do have, keep sending them to SportsCityChefs@gmail. We get those emails and responses. It's great to hear people with good reviews on us being back in football mode. Thank you to everybody out there that's listening to us, checking us out, getting their food for thought. Hopefully they can do these dishes. On that note, tell a friend that it's the chef again. And if they don't know, football is back. Now you know.
Oh, welcome to Sports City. TP Thomas is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Timeless holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to back, rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you, people.
Good morning. It's a Sports City Chef with Sunday the Brunch with Mark and TP.
Good morning.
So kick back, relax, enjoy everybody, don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday morning brunch with Mark, the Moses, and TP Timeless.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, in 2 hours of facts, and that's a fact, yeah.